Well, we've been going through 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and looking at what Paul says as a description of this love that we find in this particular chapter. And so we've noted that all of the descriptions of love, regardless of how they appear in our translations, are actually verbs. And so the things that love does is Paul's particular focus, not to say you can't use adjectives in other passages to describe love, but that's what he's doing here with these verbs. And the first two descriptions that he gives, are fundamental to the point that he wants to make, that love suffers long. This is this attribute that's described of God predominantly throughout the Old Testament, that God is slow to anger. And then on the other hand, that God is good, meaning that God does good on behalf of his people. And it gets translated by this word that often gets translated as kind. In English, love is kind, or if we had a verb form of the word kind, that love, you know, kinds, to kind of make that silly sounding. And so we have predominantly another attribute of God that is described here. And so it's Paul's way of saying that this love of which I speak is the very nature and essence and character of God. And furthermore, all the other descriptions that are given in verses 4 through 7 are really unpacking what it means for love to be long-suffering or to be kind. And so love is a more passive quality, and so I would argue that those qualities of what love does not do, and that's what we're going to focus on today, they're are a number of things love does not do, and that is an explanation of what it means for love to be long-suffering, because the very idea of long-suffering is there is some kind of difficulty, some kind of pain, some kind of temptation to do something other. It's not something that's going to come easy, and in fact, there is pressure to give in to it in the short term. In fact, it's very easy to imagine that when Tyndale was coining this word in the English language to, you know, fit into his translation, you know, he came up with this word long-suffering, and it's a pretty good word. But given the fact that we have the word short-tempered, long-tempered might have been a good counter to that. You need to be a long-tempered person. You need to have the kind of disposition that rather than flying off the hammer or impulse reacting to things, a knee-jerk reaction, that you can be so provoked so easily or someone push your buttons, because of love, that you are more concerned about the other person than yourself, that you're willing to forego things. You're willing to do without. You're willing to resist. And so not to act in certain ways in reaction to different provocations that may happen. And then, of course, the quality of being kind, of doing good for others, that's a more positive quality. And you see that, again, in all things. It rejoices with the truth as a positive thing. Bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, and so on. So we're going to be looking at these not descriptions here of what love does not do. And the first thing he says is love does not envy. So again, picking up in chapter 13, verse 4, love is patient, love is long-suffering, you know, love endures, something like that. And then love is kind, love does good. But then the third time that love is mentioned, it's at the beginning of this list of negative things. Love is not jealous or does not envy. This is a word that, you know, its literal background to it is to boil. Some translations say, don't be filled with envy. Well, that's an adequate thing. We get the idea envy is involved here. But don't boil with envy. That really is a graphic verbal picture if you think about it. And it is the idea. Now, this word can be used in a positive way, to desire good things, to be passionate about certain good things. But in this context, love does not boil with envy. And it has a personal kind of dimension to it. So it's not envying somebody's possessions like, you know, my neighbor has a nice house, and boy, I would like to have a nice house too. That's not really envy. That may be coveting, I want what they have. But it doesn't necessarily have to involve the personal aspect of it is, which I don't want them to have it. I want to have it at their expense. I begrudge them the status or the honor that they are enjoying or the possessions that they have. I'm kind of reminded of my brother who spent so many years in Romania, and as part of that, he did a lot of preaching in Moldova as well. And of course, both of those countries are former Soviet satellite nations. And they had lived under the state system where the state reigns supreme. It is elevated over the family unit. Your fundamental loyalty is not to religion. There is no God. It's not to your family. It's to the state. They are your family. And everybody's going to live equally under a communist utopia. And you would think that would breed a much more tolerant society where people are saying, well, we're all in this together. We all have the same stuff. Maybe we don't have much, but we all share in not having much together, And yet, as materialistic as capitalist systems can be, and people who live under capitalist systems can become very greedy, very materialistic, this materialism does not rise to the level that it does in the former Soviet states. And my brother gave me a simple example of that. He said there was a guy who got a goat. And instead of the neighbors thinking like, well, good for him, he got a goat, they're all like, where did he get the goat? Why does he have a goat and I don't have a goat? And it's that kind of envy over some of the most minute things. It's not even very significant whether you have a goat or don't have a goat, but just the idea that somebody had something they didn't have. And this is what happens when your fixation is on self. Where's my goat? I can't be happy for the other guy to have a goat because I'm so absorbed with, what I am deserving of. And so the idea of wanting to better themselves at somebody else's expense is kind of part of that idea. And so I want what he has, and I wish he didn't have it. It's kind of the attitude. Well, are people really like that? Yeah, unfortunately they are. You've probably known some people like this who were not simply content with what they had, and they weren't content just to be greedy for other things, but actually, again, hating the idea that other people were enjoying things that they couldn't have. And sometimes this personal dimension comes because we know the people. You read the newspaper about some guy in California that digs up a chest in his backyard and it turns out to be, worth a couple $1 million, some kind of historical, archaeological find. And you shrug your shoulders and you say, lucky guy, got him a metal detector and found some treasure in his backyard. Wasn't that great? But boy, let your next door neighbor, the same thing happened to him, and oh man, so again, some of that personal connection that starts, causing that envy that we have. Well, why him and not me? I almost bought that house. I could have been me. And it breeds this kind of corrosive, non-loving kind of approach to life, and it's because we're thinking more about self and not the other person. The second thing that Paul says here is love does not brag. This is the only time this verb occurs anywhere in the Bible, and the noun form of it, the closest thing to it in English we have is a bragger, a guy who just brags. And so there's the verb form to brag, kind of parade yourself around. Be a windbag is an expression that we have. There's a guy who's a windbag. He's talking and talking and talking, and windbags always talking about themselves. And I know some people talk all the time about all kinds of things, but a person who's always talking about themselves, it is particularly insufferable because I can't get a word in edgewise to talk about myself, right? It's irritating. And that is one of the phenomenal things that happens in human relations is, when you're being self-absorbed and you're being arrogant and you're talking about yourself, well, it just irritates me. But I can't see it in myself. That's how self-absorbed I can be. And love is not like that. And so ultimately, the very premise of this love that Paul is describing is an absolute selflessness. And because it's not about me, I'm able to suffer on behalf of the other person. I'm able to do what is good for them rather than being fixated on what's good for me. And so I don't feel any compulsion to have to better myself at somebody else's expense, and I don't feel the need to have to talk about myself. Here again, you may not have noticed how wonderful I am. And so I've got to go on some kind of PR campaign to make sure you understand the facts about just how great I really am. And, you know, blow my own horns because no one else is going to do it. Make sure I get the attention that I deserve. And so this quite literally is the verbalization of the proud spirit. You need to know, you know, how great I am. You need to know more about me, how wonderful I am. That's the attitude that is reflected here. And the next quality that is mentioned is related to it, because instead of being the verbalization of this idea where you're just talking about yourself, it's still the mentality and the attitude that is behind that kind of speech. And so love does not brag, and it is not arrogant, is how the New American Standard puts it. This is the word that means to swell up or to puff up. And it's used 7 times in the New Testament. 6 of these times it's in 1 Corinthians. And so you may think of other passages throughout 1 Corinthians. We've recently studied it. Talks about people being puffed up. For example, back in chapter 8 and verse 1, knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. And when we made the observation that there is a kind of puffing up that gives the appearance of growth, but it's not real growth. You know, and so if my arm started swelling, and I'd say, "Man, look how strong I am! Look how big my arm's getting!" It's like, "No, you're sick. You're dying. You need to go see a doctor." In the same way, there are false appearances of growth that are really morbid, and true love is what is actually going to bring constructive growth. And so again, this is to think more of yourself, to have an inflated opinion about yourself, and think more about self than you think about others. And so again, it's the mentality of this proud spirit. Clearly the idea is I'm better than you are. And very few people will come out and say that. And that's why those who do, like the windbag, they're not viewed very well in polite society. It is annoying that people talk that way. And we start couching it and veiling it in more culturally acceptable ways. You can sound so pious about this. You know, as I was preaching the other day and sharing the gospel with a couple of people I encountered, well, here I'm blowing my own horn about how much I'm out doing evangelism and helping people and how much I care and so on. Now, a person could say that and be perfectly genuine about just sharing something good that happened, but somebody else can take those same words and I'm going to promote myself because, again, I'm a better person than you are. And they can leave that impression. I'm the smartest person in the room. I'm the best preacher this church has ever had. I'm the best husband. I'm the best father. I'm the best, you know, and I suspect that's kind of how it worked with the disciples. You know, they're always arguing about who's greatest in the kingdom. Now, probably some of them were capable of being that kind of arrogant people strutting around saying, "I'm the greatest disciple of Jesus," you know. But more likely, they would say something like, "Well, you know, Jesus can count on me. You know, Peter, you remember you were walking on the water and then you started sinking like a rock." Ha ha, no pun intended. And you took your eyes off Jesus. Now, had that been me, I would have been just, you know, dancing all over the water, right? Jesus can count on me. You've let Jesus down more times than we can count. But he can count on me. So you can make it sound a lot nicer, but you're still making the point. I'm better than you are. And that's what Peter said. "Oh, you know, Jesus, I can go with you. Even if you're talking about dying, I'm willing to die for you, Jesus." Really? And of course, when the time came, he could not. And when Jesus restores him in John chapter 21, he asks him that question, do you love me more than these? And I think the way to read that is, do you love me more than these others love me? Do you think you're better than they are when it comes to loving me? And of course, he was sufficiently chastened and realized that no, his boast had proved to be an empty boast. Love is not rude or does not act unbecomingly or inappropriately. This is based upon the word for shame. So what is shameful? And that kind of depends on what the standard is to determine shame versus glory and honor. You can have that defined morally. What is morally shameful versus what is, you know, morally good? It can be a cultural thing. You know, it's rude to, you know, speak with your mouth full of food while you're chewing it. Don't do that. That's inappropriate. Well, that's not a moral thing, but it's considered socially inappropriate. So how does love behave? Well, it doesn't behave inappropriately. And so how might that find application in our situation? Well, you know, it's behavior that's inappropriate or unbecoming to the situation. Now, it may be that some people are just ignorant, they're uneducated, they don't know what is appropriate. And so that might not be a reflection of the fact that they're actually unloving, but I think assuming they know what is the appropriate way to act and they don't, it's because they're not loving. Because they're more concerned about themselves and what they want rather than thinking of the other person and modifying their behavior more in conformity with what is best for them. And so I would see a particular application of this is that kind of person who's just unconcerned about how their words or actions impact other people. Because I've encountered a lot of these people over the years. Some people even take a kind of pious delight in it. I'm just so honest. I'm just so open and transparent. I just speak my mind and let the chips fall where they may. And if anyone's got a problem with that, that's just who I am. And, you know, what they're asking me to do, if I were to change any of that, is to be dishonest, you know, to cover up, you know, the real me, you know, not be my authentic self or something like that. You know, there are some people who are so arrogant and they're so fixed on self, they can't even imagine how their words make other people feel. And they don't care. And they're just going to say what they say. And of course, these things are all tied together. So if you got the windbag who is out promoting himself and telling everybody how wonderful he is, how can that not be an application of this about how rude and unthoughtful and inconsiderate it is to be going around telling people, well, you know, I'm really better than you are. Well, you might think that you're exalting how wonderful you are, but you're again doing it at the expense of other people and making them feel bad. Do you care? And so if I were to get up here and say, I'm the greatest preacher this church has ever had, what's Nathan supposed to think of me saying something like that? Well, he's going to think, liar, you know. I know who it is. I know. And I know a lot of times people don't intend to be hurtful, but they are because they're inconsiderate and they can't even begin to empathize with other people or put themselves in their shoes. And, you know, often, you know, someone might come to this person and say, do you realize you hurt so-and-so's feelings when you said that? How would a Christian, a loving person, respond to say, that's their problem? Well, you know, I didn't intend any wrong by it, and they're just sinning to assume the worst about what I said. That's on them. And if it makes them feel bad, then good. Maybe that'll teach them to quit making assumptions. You know, your first impulse ought to be, man, I didn't intend to cause anyone to feel bad. I won't be able to sleep tonight knowing I hurt their feelings. You know, and so, you know, what kind of person are we going to be? Do we act in a way that is becoming and so on? So I'm going to do whatever I want, whether you like it or not. You know, that kind of summarizes the attitude here. And you've probably, again, encountered many people in this regard. I've known a Christian who practically said these words. Yeah, I'm just going to do whatever I want, whether you like it or not. And it's just hard to reconcile that kind of language with the gospel of Jesus Christ. And what follows after that is that love is not self-serving. Your version may say, does not seek its own. Quite literally, does not seek the things of oneself, right? And that's a pretty good translation. I think that's probably adequate for most of us to say, yeah, I can wrap my mind around what that is. I've chosen here self-serving because that seems to summarize the idea here, really, of a lot of these ideas that we've talked about. We're so focused on self and promoting of self, that's all we can think about. There is a kind of attribute about love, the way most people think of love, that is very possessive. I love pizza. That means I got to have some pizza, right? Or I love this girl, so I've got to possess her. You know, she's got to be my wife, right? That kind of possessive love, which is self-serving, you know, it's this attachment or this attraction that I have that I want to indulge in. It's all about me and how I feel. That's not the kind of love we're talking about here. But a love that takes the focus off of self and off of my feelings, and it's focused more on the will. What is the right thing to do for this person, even when I don't feel like doing it? That's the kind of love that Paul is talking about. I'm not seeking my own things, but I'm seeking the things that are the good for others. And of course, a very good passage along this very line is what Paul reminds us of in Philippians chapter 2 when he holds up again the very character of Christ. You know, think this in your own mind, what was in the mind of Christ, this humility. And just prior to him saying that, he says in verses 3 and 4 of Philippians chapter 2, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves, not looking out for your own personal interest, but also for the interest of others. And so again, that seeking the things of self. Don't do that. You're seeking the things of the others. And that's the way Christ thought. That's what Christ sought. And we need to imitate that in our own life. And so here's the kind of person who insists on his own way. It's got to be his way, my way or the highway kind of thing. And whereas, you know, when you're rude and inappropriate and unbecoming in your behavior, because you just don't give any care or concern at all about how your conduct and your words impact other people, but now you have a great concern for how the behavior, the actions, the words of other people impact you, right? It's got to be my way, the way I want things that are satisfactory to me. And so you'll do whatever I want, whether you like it or not. Again, I've met people like this many times in life. They got to have their way. And very rarely does it come across socially acceptable to say, hey, I got to have my way. And the way you normally make that work is, oh, it's got to be God's way. And you know what? God's way just happens to be my preferred way of doing things. Isn't that amazing how smart God is, that he agrees with me all the time? And so you make it a moral issue. You know, so not just got to have my way, but I'll make a moral case out of it by saying that's what God wants. Well, that's not what, true love will do. And then love does not take offense or is not easily provoked. This is a word that's the root word of it is vinegar. So something that's got a very strong acidic kind of smell or taste to it. And so you picture, you know, again, as a verbal picture here, you know, taking a swig of vinegar and, you know, getting that kind of, oh, man, that was not nice at all in a negative kind of way here. And so it's some sharp kind of blow to us. And there's a kind of person who even the smallest little thing is like, you know, striking them with a severe blow. And the smallest little things are provocations, right? So someone who's easily provoked or goes into paroxysms. Normally I wouldn't put that up there, but that's the actual word that we get this English word from this Greek word. A paroxysm, normally we think of a paroxysm as a fit that someone goes into, but that's pretty much the way some people are. They throw a fit. You know, it's like a temper tantrum because they don't get their way, right? And although we normally associate that with small children, there are a lot of adults. They're throwing temper tantrums because they're so easily provoked. They snap. And it's not that they snap at everything, but there are certain hot buttons that, you know, if you know the right button to push, this is just the wrong thing to say that set them off. That's the person that falls into this category. And so who are these people that are easily irritated by things? Well, they're people that are hung up on self. It's all they can think about. How does this affect me? And there are irritations in life. They're unavoidable. You know, if you drive a car, somebody is going to cut you off. Somebody's going to drive too fast. Somebody's going to drive too slow. Someone's going to, you know, veer in your lane. And so what do you do? Well, there are some people that are easily provoked and they'll fly into a rage at the drop of a hat. Well, love doesn't do that. You know, love's impulse is to say, oh, those poor people, you know, I wonder if they can even see. I wonder if their, you know, turn signal's not even working, you know, whatever. Here's a kind of person that tries to control people through intimidation. You know, if you know the person's going to blow up and get angry if they don't have their way, or you don't do it just so, then, that'll be motivation to make sure you do it the way they want it done. So, you know, you can't do anything right. You know, they get offended, upset by everything you do. You try to please them in every particular, cross every T, dot every I, and it's not going to be good enough. Well, love is not like that. And so we need to be careful to avoid that. And then he says, love does not keep track or take into account a wrong or injustice. You know, it's the idea of keeping a ledger of debts that people owe you and credits that people pay you, but particularly keeping a track of the wrongs that people have done to you. So here's a person who refuses to forgive, that, you know, they're going to use your guilt as a club to bludgeon you with and keep making you feel bad. And so, you know, these last several ones here are talking about unpleasant things that happen in your life you don't like, and you can't really control them. So what do you do about it? Well, I'm going to make sure people know I'm upset about this. And furthermore, I'm keeping a list, and I'm going to see that, you know, I get my pound of flesh, and it's going to be paid back, and so on. And again, here's a list of all the wrong things you're doing. And, you know, I'm reminded of some business meetings in a church I was familiar with where some guy would want to drag out his list of things that were done, you know, 20 years before and bring that up to talk about. And it's like, really? That's literally what the Bible says don't do, right? I even had a situation back in Indiana where there was a church and the elders wanted to meet with me because there was a member that was moving from their town to Muncie, where I was preaching, and this lady had caused all kinds of trouble in their congregation. She had done all kinds of terrible things. And she'd be the first person to tell you, I did all these terrible things. And I repent. I tried to make right what I could to restore and repair the damage I've done. But she had hurt those people so much that the elders could not let it go. And they said, well, I'm going to need to meet with you. And I said, what are we going to talk about? Well, all these terrible things she's done. I said, well, did she repent of it? Oh, yeah. Well, I said, there's nothing to talk about. That's over with. Now, if she's still doing stuff, no evidence of that. It's this, you know, back the last year, this and that. And, well, I said, you know, where do you keep your ledger, you know? You're keeping track of every sin and wrong that people are doing, and not just because you want to keep track, but now you want to share it with me so I know all the wrong stuff she's done. I said, that's not how love behaves. And so we don't keep track of the wrongs that are done. A very natural thing to do. It's human nature, but no, we don't do that. if we love as Christ loves. And finally, he says, love does not rejoice in unrighteousness or wickedness. It doesn't gloat over the sin and wrongdoing. And so, you know, someone has done some dirt to us, and then we find out, hey, they got cancer. You know, just laugh and say, well, they're wonderful. Well, they're going to get what they deserve. Well, finally, you know, karma's coming around and going to punish those people. Well, love doesn't feel that way. It doesn't take pleasure in saying, I told you so, right? Now, I'm not saying it's always wrong to tell people, I told you so. There's some good Bible examples of people saying, I told you so. Some people need to be told that. But when we relish in that and you take a lot of pleasure in the downfall of other people and their sin, I'm reminded of something Phil Roberts said many years ago. He said, it may be occasionally appropriate from the pulpit to call out a person's name because they are a sinner. But when we do that, it oughtn't to be with a smile on our face and glee in our voice, but in tears and brokenness and sorrow. And that's absolutely right. Because we don't gloat, we don't rejoice over the sin that other people get caught up in. And so I would encourage us to think about this passage. And it makes for one of these good passages to read, kind of personalize it. I like to do that with Ephesians chapter 5. And it talks about the husband and the wife. And you can read that for, you know, Braden and Ami as they want to get married and, you know, enter into that covenant relationship. And so, you know, you read a passage like this in 1 Corinthians chapter 13 to verse 4, Tom suffers long. And I don't get very far into the description, and I'm like, you know, at what point does this become unbearable? Tom is kind. He does good for others. Tom is not envious, does not brag, is not puffed up, does not act unbecomingly, does not seek his own things, is not provoked, does not keep a track of wrongs, does not rejoice in unrighteousness. But Tom rejoices with the truth. And Tom bears all things. And Tom believes all things. And Tom hopes all things. And Tom endures all things. Well, that's certainly Tom's goal. And I hope it's the goal of all of us. But to what extent we fall short of that, we need to think soberly about and see ways that we might try to be more like Jesus. Well, we're going to be partaking of the Lord's Supper and think of Jesus. Do this in remembrance of me, this crucified Christ, this person who exemplified the very love that we're talking about, a love of perfect selflessness, and one who was willing to sacrifice and suffer to serve other people. And so let's think about this love as exemplified in Jesus. And when you read the passage that Christ suffers long, and Christ does good for us, and Christ does not envy, and so on, there's no ridiculousness to that claim. That's exactly who Jesus was and who we need to aspire to be. So let's think about these things as we sing the next couple of songs and partake of the Lord's Supper together.